thank you so much for tuning into our podcast every week. As you know, sometimes we invite special guests to join us and talk about travel with us. This week, we were so excited to talk to Peter, a pilot for a major airline, that we ended up talking for a full hour. So instead of pushing that whole episode on you in one long chunk, we're going to break it into part one and part two. This week, we present part one of episode 136. Enjoy!
Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of Fly Away, a weekly podcast from Outlander Travel about the thing we love most, travel. We're glad you're joining us this week. Our goal is to inform, educate, and inspire. We hope that tuning in for our weekly chats will help push you outside of your comfort zone and add some new experiences to your bucket list. We also welcome ideas for topics, so if there's something you'd like to hear more about, let us know. My name is Laura, and tonight I'm joined by fellow Outlander agents Sandy and Elizabeth, and our special guest, Peter Rogers. Peter is a pilot with a major airline where he currently flies to Beijing, Tokyo, Shanghai, London, Barcelona, and Paris. He's also flown for the Navy and several domestic routes. We asked him to join us today because we thought that you, like several of us, have found yourself during airline travel, wondering, how come they do that? Lucky for us, and lucky for you, we get to have those questions answered by an industry expert, or as the saying goes, straight from the pilot's mouth. So let's get started. So, you and I have been friends for a long time, so I'm going to know the answer to some of these questions, but why don't you tell us a little bit about how long you've been a pilot, and what does it take to become a pilot?
Well, I'm happy to be here, and thanks for having me on your show today. I started out when I was a little kid dreaming about flying, and grew up to actually be a pilot. But what I did start doing was started flying hang gliders when I was just at the end of my college days, and then went on to decide that I couldn't hold an honest job, so I went on to join the Navy. I joined the Navy, and I flew for a total of 20 years for the United States Navy. And following that, I got a job with American Airlines. And so I've really been flying for about 30 years now, 35, actually.
So do you just have to keep flying to keep up your, certification to be a pilot, or is there a continuing education you need to do?
Well, there's continuing education, and you do have to have flying currency. And that went from the time that I joined the Navy to up to present day. As an airline pilot, we have to log a certain number of takeoffs and landings every single 90 days just in order to be legal to carry passengers with us. And we also have to have a minimum number of flight hours, and we also do quarterly recurrent education. So it keeps us up to speed on current topics, whether it's dealing with our airline and our procedures and policies, whether it's dealing with international procedures, domestic regulations. One of the big topics that we really concentrate on are safety. Safety issues, not only just with flying, but with cargo, with passengers, and all aspects of the job, because that's really the it's really what we provide for the public, is a safe travel from point A to point B.
And there are times, are there, like if you're going to fly a bigger airplane or a different model airplane, don't you have to go for special training just for that?
We sure do. Every time that we switch airplanes, and I'll back up just a little bit, every 9 months we have to go down to our training facility, which for me is in either Dallas, Fort Worth, or in Charlotte. And we go down there and we have a multi-day training course that we have to do every single 9 months. And we have written tests, oral examinations, and we also have simulator evaluations. And we have to deal with every possible emergency you could think of, all sorts of things that you hope that you would never see in an airplane. But if you deal with them in a simulator and you know how to do it, if it were to ever happen to you in real life, then you're fully prepared to do that. Now, back to your question, when you switch airplanes, you go through an extensive training course, and that takes you all the way from learning every single nut and bolt on the airplane, all of the systems, all of the equipment on the airplane, as well as its flying characteristics, the emergency procedures associated with it, and hours of simulator flying before you get a what's called a check ride. And an FAA examiner gives you a check ride that certifies you and gives you a license to actually fly the plane. And then once you've finished all that certification, then you go out for what's called line-oriented experience, where you actually go out with an evaluator, and you go out in the airplane, and you fly the real airplane for the first time, and learn how to actually, not learn how to fly the airplane, but learn how to fly it in real time, mm-hmm. as opposed to in a simulator, where if something goes wrong in a simulator, they can just hit the freeze button and stop you right where you're at. And in the airplane, it's all happening real time, and you've got a couple hundred people sitting behind you.
No pressure.
So what do you...
Actually, there is no pressure at all. People ask me all the time, So do you feel a certain weight of responsibility with all those people behind you? And my answer to them is, not really. I'm very concerned about my own personal safety, and I'm going to make sure that I do everything to get myself from point A to point B, and I'm going to make sure that you get there with me.
That totally makes sense. So I have a kind of a silly question, which is, so between the simulator and then flying the real plane, how good are our simulators now? Is it a markedly different experience, or are the simulators good enough that when you then sit in the cockpit of that plane, do you feel like you're at least... maybe you've done it once before.
The simulator is such an accurate representation. The simulators stand on hydraulic legs, and those hydraulic legs move the simulator up and down and back and forth. So it provides a real-time sensation that the airplane is flying. So if you think about when you're sitting in the plane and they run up the engines and let go of the brakes and you feel yourself being pushed back into your seat, mm-hmm. that's exactly what we feel in the simulator. And when the plane turns and when it lands and stops and brakes to a stop, those sensations are mirrored completely in real time in the simulator. And there are also visual displays that fill all the cockpit windows. And it looks like our newest simulator, I fly the 787 Boeing aircraft, and those new simulators have so much realism. They have traffic moving on the highways down below you.
Wow.
There are other airplanes in the sky flying around you. And it is so realistic that the FAA has authorized the company to issue a license based solely on training in a simulator.
Wow,
that is extreme.
So I just have to shout out, my husband works for GE, and they build those engines on the 787.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, surprise reveal.
Those engines are so amazingly reliable.
Well, that's good to hear.
Because her husband is not.
He does quality for that engine, actually, the GE90, mm-hmm. I guess. Well, I actually know. Yeah. I don't know. It kind of goes in one ear and out the other. I'm just like, just keep us in the air as long as we
can.
So those planes are huge, though. So is there one kind of plane you like flying better when you're on those really long flights?
Boy, that's a... I used to fly the Boeing 777, the 777, before I started flying the Boeing 787. And both of those planes are absolutely beautiful. They are both state-of-the-art, but the 787 is the newest airplane out there, and it really, the systems on it are eye-watering. It's a pleasure to fly. It is so incredibly automated, and its ability to alert you of any issues on board the airplane. And ergonomically, the one thing we always joke about is on every airplane, as you would imagine, it should get better and better with each succeeding generation of airplane. But on every single airplane you go into as a pilot, you move from, let's say, a modern airplane like the 767 to a very modern airplane like the 777, and you're like, this is amazing. And then you find something, and you go, really? They didn't fix that? and these are minor things. What it really has to do is more with ergonomics and how you would think it should be done as a pilot. And with the 787, one of the things that we all do is we look at this one thing. It's called a CDU, and it's basically a keypad and display screen. And on all the other airplanes we've come from, everybody who flies it looks at this display screen, and they're like, they couldn't put in an actual physical keypad on it? And it's so funny because the flat screen that you have to move a cursor around and select everything on is covered in fingerprints because everyone reaches forward and tries to hit the physical buttons that don't exist anymore. And so you're just like, who was thinking that one up?
I'm surprised they don't ask for your opinions whenever they start designing stuff. I mean,
no, they do actually. Yeah. They
just ignore them.
And they actually take tons and tons of pilot input. But even so, they come up with a couple things that you just scratch your head.
People listening to this will be hearing you as a male voice, but we know that there's an increasing number of female pilots. Have you seen a big increase? Or, you know, one of our listeners has asked, why are there not more female pilots? Do you have any insight on that?
There are actually lots and lots of female pilots, and they're increasing with every single day. What you have to keep in mind is when you see all these, you know, old, and I'm going to call them old, captains, you know, these guys that have been flying for, you know, significantly longer than I have, that's back in the days when I joined the Navy. There were very, very, very few female military pilots. And it used to be that the airlines got most of their pilots from the military. And with time passing, the need for large quantities of pilots by the military services has decreased. And the civilian ranks have increased. So you get a lot more pilots that are coming through civilian ranks, and those certainly were the majority of female pilots that came into the profession. When I was in the Navy, initially women could not be in combat roles, and they can now, and so it just meant that there were increasing numbers of opportunities for women in aviation on the military side. And the same, it was always such a boys' club and a male-dominated profession that it's taken a long time for it to change. Quite honestly, we actually have some transgendered pilots at my company, and my friends at other major airlines say that they have a number of transgendered pilots also. So, you know, it's becoming a much more diverse workforce. And just the same way, there used to be very, very few minority pilots, whether they were Hispanic or Black or Asian. And those numbers are increasing right apace with the increasing number of women in the cockpit.
So the whole field is becoming more diverse, is what you're saying.
Yeah, very, very much.
So I'm curious about the military thing, because I guess I was sort of, maybe I'm old too, but I kind of figured that that was still the case, that most pilots do come from the military. You retire from the military, that's where you learn your skills, and then you move. So you're saying that's not necessarily the case anymore? Is it more 50-50 now? Do you have any sense of numbers?
It is more 50-50. Certainly, the military is a great way to get into the aviation profession, but there's also the civilian route. And I've jokingly referred to it to people when they asked. I said, well, there are two ways of becoming a pilot. You either sell your soul to the military or you sell your soul to the civilian world. And in the military, you get free training, great pay, but you're also on the hook to do their beck and call for 8 years. Mm-hmm. So you know, sign up for 8 years, or you can spend the same 8 years slaving away for really poor wages, but being able to walk away and go find another job at any time that you want. So you're selling your soul either way.
But it's very rewarding in the end, right?
I don't know if you guys know this, but Peter knows. My nephew is actually at a school to become a pilot. Mm-hmm. And he's been there. And he's at Embry-Riddle in Florida. And it's from the moment that boy got there, they have like 92 planes at that college. And it's expensive. It's like $40,000 a year to go to that school. But from the moment he got there, he was flying like almost like 3 days later. You know, they begin mm-hmm. to. Mm-hmm. Now he went there with his. What's the first level?
Probably with a private pilot's license.
Yes, with his private pilot's license. But you know, they are up in those planes 7 days a week. You know, all hours of the night, all hours of the day. Those guys are flying, but it's an expensive proposition. And there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of flying time and different levels and, you know.
Well, that seems like a good thing to me.
Yeah, really. Lots of practice.
So while we're talking about hours and hours and comfort and that sort of thing, and you mentioned ergonomics before, for those of us who have flown, I see one of your routes is Beijing. That's a really long flight. Are you more comfortable than I am when I sit in coach? What is that cockpit like for that sort of period of time? And how do you deal with that long time of being sort of on duty?
Well, if you're sitting in coach for a flight to Beijing, I am feeling your pain. but I'm not feeling it up in the cockpit.
Well, that's good.
I've got to say, our seats are very ergonomically designed. They are very comfortable. They've got adjustable. You can adjust the height up and down, forward and back from the console. You can adjust the lumbar support, the support underneath your thighs. So it's very, very adjustable. So you can adjust the tilt on it so that you've got, I'm a person that likes to sit pretty much upright in their chair. And, you know, a lot of guys I know like to slouch a lot. And so I come back into the cockpit and they've got the seat leaned way back. And
it's like those Corvette drivers that sort of lay all the way back.
But, it's very adjustable and it's really a very comfortable seat because, you know, we're required to be at the controls wearing our seatbelt the entire time that we're on duty on the flight deck.
Wow.
Well, that's a good segue too. Let's take Beijing since we're on that. How many folks are on that flight deck with you, and how do you stay on duty and off duty?
Well, the flight over to Beijing is about 13 to 14 hours, depending on the winds and the routing that we take. And for that flight, what we do is we have four pilots. And each one of those pilots are fully qualified to be the pilot in command of the aircraft at any time. And so what we do is we will have a captain and three first officers, and the captain and one of the first officers will be sitting in the pilot seats. And then there are two jump seats directly behind them, and that's where the two other first officers will be sitting. And we're all up on the flight deck. We have different duties before the plane departs. One is to get the cockpit set up. Another is to pull the paperwork, check the weather. And this may sound silly, but make the bunks. Because you want to have those all ready to go when it's time to take a nap.
Are the bunks in the cockpit here?
No, they aren't. They're up over the top of the first class section.
Okay.
Wow.
But another thing that someone has to do is go out and do a pre-flight inspection of the airplane. And that's walking outside around the perimeter of the airplane and inspecting all the tires, the brakes, the wings, you know, every section of the airplane. And making sure that it's in, you know, good working condition. But when it comes to the gate closing, the door closing, and then pushing away from the gate, at that point, it's the four of us sitting in the on the flight deck, and the two first officers back in the jump seats, it's their job really to look up information as the other two pilots need it, as well as to monitor what the captain and first officer are doing all the way out through through the takeoff and the climb out. So at about 30 minutes after takeoff, what happens is those two first officers sitting in the jump seats, they go on their first break. And they'll go back, and you can either go to a seat in the cabin or you can go up to the bunk. And there are two bunks, and they're big enough to crawl into and lay down and sleep very comfortably. And there's also a chair up there if you want to sit up there in a chair. But once you go up there, once you go on break, you're on break for about, on a typical Beijing, you'd be on break for about 3 hours on your first break. And then the two first officers would come up and relieve the captain and the other first officer. They'd go on a 3 hour break. And then we just take rotating shifts of roughly 3 hours each. So you'd have the first half hour of the flight after takeoff that we're all up on the flight deck. And then people are alternating breaks for the duration of the flight. And then about the last 45 minutes to an hour of the flight, everyone's back up on the flight deck. Because at that time, even though you may have been taking a nap and you may have gotten nice 3 hour long sleep, it's the end of a 14 hour work day and everybody's starting to get fatigued. So everyone has to really be on top of their game, paying attention as the plane comes in, especially into a foreign country. And the reason I say especially with a foreign country is because they're, even though everyone is required to be able to speak English and be proficient at that point you're dealing with language barriers based on people's I'm losing my mind here on people's dialect and their accent. Mm-hmm. You know, so they may speak English, but every once in a while the two of you will look over at each other and go, what did he say? And with four of us that works great, because usually a couple of people say, you know, he said to descend to 10,000 feet. And you're like, okay. And if you have any question, you just ask them again, and they'll say it again, and you can usually figure out what they're saying. But you know, foreign accents on English can still be difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. So we're all back up on the flight deck, and that really provides a high level of redundancy to ensure that there are no errors made during that critical phase of flight, which is descent, approach, and landing.
So you use the term first officer, and I hear the term a lot as a passenger of co-pilot. Are those the same things, or are they two different designations?
No, they are the exact same thing.
Okay.
Some crews call them a captain and a co-pilot. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a more common term, but most airlines in the industry use captain and first officer.
So in general, a co-pilot or a first officer, will they be a fully qualified pilot that they're just in a secondary position for that flight?
Yes. At our company, every single first officer is required to be a fully licensed pilot on that airplane, meaning that he's qualified to occupy the captain's seat or the co-pilot's seat.
Okay.
And so you're qualified to fly the plane and perform all the duties of the captain or working as a first officer. And typically when we're flying, we refer to our roles as the pilot flying and the pilot not flying. and the reason is because everyone needs to get landings and everyone needs to physically fly the airplane. And so the person who is flying the airplane is the pilot flying. And then the person who is monitoring communications, performing navigational tasks, and other duties, that would be the pilot not flying. And so, for instance, let's say a crew were to fly a flight from Chicago to Miami, and then from Miami back to Chicago. On the way down there, let's say the captain flies the plane down and the first officer is the pilot not flying, and then on the way back they would reverse roles. That way each one gets a takeoff and a landing during the entire day.
So is that something that scheduling at headquarters determines, or is that something that you in the cockpit can sort of make a call?
It's a coin toss.
Okay.
It's a verbal coin toss. Mm-hmm. A lot of times a captain will say, what do you want to do? You want to fly over or you want to fly back?
Okay.
And you can say, well, gosh, I'd like to fly over. You know, I haven't flown to Beijing for a while. And so we just divide up the who's going to fly and who's going to be the pilot not flying just right there at the gate usually.
So then,
and what are the other two people in the cockpit? They're also licensed pilots too, aren't they?
They are. And if you're flying in the what are referred to in a lot of companies as the relief pilot position, where you're sitting back in the jump seat, then during that flight over to the Far East and back, you wouldn't get a takeoff or a landing.
So you'd be a pilot
during
not
that
flying.
Flight. So you, but on your next flight, you might. Mm-hmm. And as long as you make your minimums for maintaining your currency to be licensed, as I said, we have to have 3 takeoffs and landings every single 90 days at a minimum in order to be legal to carry passengers. And if we don't get enough of those, they just send us down to the training facility to do a simulator, get some practice, do some takeoffs and landings, and then send us on our way.
But every single one of you in the cockpit is licensed to fly that plane and could land it in an emergency.
Absolutely.
Right.
So then,
to clarify that.
To continue the idea, you've flown to Beijing now. How long do you rest before you make the return journey?
Typically, we're there anywhere from, on international layovers, we're there for at least 24 hours. And while that may not sound like enough, actually, that is a, that's kind of actually about the perfect length layover from a fatigue standpoint. It certainly isn't from a tourism standpoint.
Yes, I was going to say, so you probably just rest that whole time then for the 20 hours.
You spend a lot of the time resting, and as a guy flying international, you do one of two things. You either learn how to manage your sleep, or you go back to stateside domestic flying. And the thing about having a longer layover, because I've actually had layovers where the schedule had me over there for like 4 days before I came back. And that's really hard, because what happens is your body starts shifting over to their time zone. And of course, while you're over there, you're not going to sleep all day and stay up all night. So you really are acclimatizing to being over in the Far East. And then you have to turn around and come home, and you just feel beat up for a couple of days once you get home.
You've basically done a long weekend in China, which sounds ridiculous when you say it like that, doesn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of fun because you can actually go someplace and see something, take a trip to the Great Wall, you know, go see some more far-flung destinations. Whereas with a 24-hour layover, you tend to do stuff right there, you know, in the city that you're in.
Do you have, I swear this is going to be a very long podcast. I'm sorry, because I have a million questions. Do you have any different passport than I do as a pilot? Is there any special consideration for people who do this for a living?
I just make sure I get the thick passport that has the extra pages in it. Because some countries stamp your passport every single time you come and go. Other countries stamp it once and then you're pretty much good. So it's really no different. I mean, I have working visas.
Mm-hmm.
I have a working visa for China and one for France. And those are just required by that country.
And they're longer. Whereas, they're longer term, right? Like the China working visa is a few years, right?
It's good for, I believe, 10 years. Yeah. But the issue is it's only good. I actually had to recently go and get a Chinese visa because my working visa is not valid in China to travel as a tourist.
Okay.
And Kevin and I are getting ready to throw ourselves on an airplane and go run off and run around China for a few days. But and so we had to both make sure that we had our paperwork in order. Mm-hmm. But it's just a standard American passport.
Okay.
Hi, thanks again for listening. Please be sure to tune in next week for the exciting conclusion.